You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, volatility continues to grip global financial markets as the U.S. and the U.K. cut off Russian oil. Stocks, bonds, tech swinging wildly. We'll bring you the market moves. Plus, Apple unveils a new 5G iPad and iPhone with its faster signature chip. But how will the global economic uncertainty, inflation, rising gas prices impact consumer demand? We'll discuss. And Mandiant off the market. Google beats out Microsoft in its second biggest acquisition ever. How this changes the cyber defense landscape with Ukraine and Russia-related hack attacks on the rise.
The new iPhone SE brings the advanced features and exceptional performance of A15 to our most affordable iPhone. It's going to be great for existing iPhone users who want a highly capable and compact iPhone, and for new users who want to experience iPhone for the first time.
Apple CEO Tim Cook there, the company's first product event of 2022, kicking off what's likely to be its most prolific year yet for new product releases. I'm going to break the event down with Julie Osk of Forrester Research and our very own Mark Gurman. So, Mark, we got a new iPhone, a new iPad Air, we got the M1 chip in more products. Talk to us about the most significant updates we saw today.
Yeah, I think the two most significant product updates we saw today was the new iPhone SE as well as the Mac Studio Next Studio Display. I'll consider that, you know, one combined product line. So starting with the SE, I think that's significant because I think it's going to bring over a lot of switchers to the iPhone, particularly people who want to get a somewhat low-priced 5G phone, right? I think the big news for the SE is 5G. Now, I'm not of the school of thought that thinks 5G has really moved the needle in terms of performance, but I do believe 5G has been an extremely key marketing term for Apple, Samsung, and other phone makers, and of course the carriers, you know, for the most part. So I think that is going to drive some interest. Now, the Mac Studio and the Mac Studio Display, I think the display at $1,600 is going to do fairly well. Consumers have been looking for an Apple design, Apple sold the display since they discontinued their own cinema displays several years ago, I think about 6 years ago at this point. At $1,600, it's about a third of the price of their $5,000 to $6,000 Pro Display XDR, so I think that is going to be a very nice offering. This new M1 Ultra chip, I think, is really going to give Intel a run for its money on the mid-tier, sort of inching towards the high end as well on their chip lineup. And I think this Mac Studio, it's going to be low volume, but it's going to be popular amongst creative types, video editing, photo editors, engineers, etc.
Julie, Apple's coming off a record-setting holiday quarter, but being thrust into several months of global economic uncertainty. It's paused services in Russia, cut off product sales there. How do you think these updates will actually drive demand in the coming quarters in the context of what's happening on the macroeconomic level?
Yeah, so I would echo what Mark said. When we look at so 91% of consumers in the United States and North America already own a smartphone. So the way that you grow share is by taking it from Android. And our data shows that of the iPhone smartphone owner purchasers in the past 3 months, 6% came from Android devices. So it looks like Apple is making progress there. Also, when we look at households, 42% own a tablet today. So there's a lot of upside for Apple there. And when we look at streaming TV services, we show that consumers are watching upwards of 4 to 5 hours of streaming TV and games each day. And Apple's third today, with Amazon being in first place. So there's a lot of upside for Apple as it continues to build on its product portfolio, including the services. So I would echo Mark's comments today. And then certainly the chipsets are impressive. That's always going to give them an advantage, not just in putting more performance, more power efficient devices into smaller and thinner packages. That's always going to be a winning formula. But as we look forward into future experiences, having that kind of power on a device and being able to do things like computer vision and speech recognition and security, facial recognition on device are all very powerful attributes of those devices.
So, Julie, are you worried about consumer demand, though? Obviously, we're worried about, rising gas prices on top of inflation. Could that impact demand for these devices over the next few months?
So I'm not an economist. So, the answer is possibly. We haven't seen a slowdown. We all thought the pandemic would impact our spending. That was 2 years ago. That proved to be wrong. So while not an economist, we don't yet see that in our numbers when we look at consumers' planned purchases over the next 3 to 6 months. But certainly, given what's going on in Ukraine day to day, it's hard to have perfect information.
And Mark, obviously focusing on the day to day, we know that Apple paused product sales in Russia. There have been calls from the Ukrainian government for Apple to cut off the App Store. Are you expecting Apple to make any more aggressive moves in the region or not?
I mean, I saw Pepsi, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Starbucks today. Really, the levers Apple pulled in Russia are the big ones they could have done, right? They could have paused sales. They could have removed some of the Russian news apps from external app stores outside of Russia. They stopped exports into their sales channels into the country there and did some changes to maps and other services. But I think pulling the App Store or disabling, people have called for them to disable iPhones in Russia. I personally think that would be a gigantic step that I don't think the company is ready to take. Now, at the same time, they do have services like Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, books and podcasts in Russia. And if they were to take those offline, that would match some of the moves you're seeing from the Netflix of the world that have pulled their service temporarily in Russia. What they did do earlier this week is they paused search ads, which is their advertising service inside of the App Store, so developers can no longer sell ads in their store in Russia. Will there be more to come? I think it's possible. But as of today, they haven't done anything additional.
Speaking of TV Plus, Major League Baseball games coming to Apple TV Plus, which is super cool, except for the fact that MLB and the players are in the middle of a lockout and regular season games the first couple of weeks have been canceled. No deal in sight at this point. Is this something that you think could be material to subscriptions to Apple TV Plus or just a nice to have?
I mean, I'll tell you, I'm a Lakers fan. That was for Julie.
Sorry. No, go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead, Mark. Julie, I'll let you get a crack at it, too.
Okay, I'm an NBA fan, first and foremost, not an MLB fan. So if this was an NBA-related deal, maybe it would get me to sign up. We also don't know when this is actually going to kick off because of the negotiations in the MLB world right now. But I do think this is just the first of many. We're probably going to see a racing deal, given some Eddie Q, their head of services, is big into that, as is their head of marketing or former head of marketing, Phil Schiller. I think we'll see additional sports over time. They do have some relationships with the NBA. There's also been talk about NFL. So I think two games a week on Friday nights is not really going to move the needle for Apple TV Plus. What does move the needle for me is the fact that they are trying to get these deals done. And it's possible you'll have one service, Apple TV Plus, that has several different sports leagues all integrated, whereas some of the competitors either have only one, two, or none at this point.
Julie, I am a baseball fan, so I'll give you 30 seconds. You take a swing. How important is MLB?
Yeah. Yeah, I would echo what Mark said. I think when we look at, you know, why aren't people cutting the cord yet from their cable operators or satellite operators for TV? It is because of live sports. I think the question that comes into play, though, is becoming very fragmented now for consumers. I can't just go one place and get all the sports that I want. You know, I'm going to a lot of different streaming services, get Thursday night football, Friday night baseball, Sunday night football, whatever it may be. And so it's we'll see how it plays out long term with consumers, but definitely directionally, it's the right place to go.
All right. Julie Ask, Forrester, Mark Gurman, who covers Apple, of course, for Bloomberg News. Thank you both. More companies joining the growing list of brands suspending operations in Russia amid its invasion of Ukraine. The latest now, PayPal, which is not the only payments company to pull out of the country. MasterCard and Visa announced over the weekend they cut off their networks as a result of the war. Coming up, securing the deal. It is the second biggest acquisition ever for Google. Google buying the cybersecurity for Mandiant, $5.4 billion, aiming to take on Amazon and Microsoft in the cloud. What it means next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Agreed to buy the cybersecurity for Mandiant for $5.4 billion cash. It is the company's second biggest deal ever. It'll give Google more tools to protect its cloud clients by responding more quickly to online threats. Joining us now, our Bloomberg tech reporter, Nico Grant, who covers Alphabet for us. Nico, why Google and not Microsoft, which was also in competition for this deal, and what does it mean?
Well, Google is a company that's trying to catch up to Microsoft and Amazon in the cloud, and also when it comes to offering cybersecurity products. Microsoft kicked the tires at Mandiant and was engaged in talks, and our reporting is that more than a week ago, Microsoft decided to exit the process, not feeling that Mandiant's business, which was so dependent on cyber events that happened and providing consulting services, Microsoft didn't think that was the best strategic fit for its business. Google, meanwhile, has tried to take advantage of the environment we're in right now, in which you have many cyber attacks that are happening. You have the war of Russia in Ukraine that is happening, that's raising the specter and fears of even more. And Google can say to customers, we can prevent cyber attacks from happening in the first place, and if they do, we will be best at detecting them and helping you respond to them. And then we'll use that knowledge we learn to protect all other clients.
What impact will this have on the cyber defense landscape as we see the number of hack attacks tied to the Russia-Ukraine evolving conflict continue to ratchet up?
Yeah, this is a major concern right now, and there have been reports from Google as well as others that they've seen many attempts to hack Ukrainians and Russians and their organizations as part of this. This is going to be something that Google will say will be very helpful for its existing clients who may want to try out Mandiant and who could choose to buy access to Mandiant's intelligence. Ultimately, obviously, Mandiant is looking at threats all across the web. It's done a lot of reporting and research on what Chinese hackers and Russian hackers are doing. And that becomes a big part of, you know, the advisory work that they do with clients more broadly. And so Mandiant will be telling customers right now, these are the types of attacks, this is how it might happen, here's what you can learn.
All right, Nico Grant, thanks for your reporting on that. We'll see if that deal in fact closes, gets any regulatory scrutiny as well. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. Well, on this International Women's Day, we're taking a moment to celebrate how much women have achieved and how much work there is left to do. Recent data from PitchBook shows that so far in 2022, startups with only female founders have snatched just 2.1% of venture capital. Same as last year, same as 2020. I want to bring in Lux Capital's Dina Shakir for more. So Dina, they've already started compiling the data for this year, and it's no better than it was last year, 2%, which makes no sense, of course, when women are half the population. What gives?
Well, first of all, happy International Women's Day, Emily, and thank you so much for having me and for bringing this important topic to the conversation. I am so hopeful, and as I told you last week, I would actually say I'm optimistic AF. The data is not quite up to date in terms of where we are for 2022, at least from what I'm seeing. I think there is still tremendous opportunity. I have to say, and maybe I'm biased, the companies that I'm seeing are not only solo women founders who are coming from deeply technical and clinical fields, but across the board, more diverse than I've ever seen in prior years. Things are changing, and I expect the data to follow suit.
Okay, what about check writers like yourself? 14.3% of check writers now are women. We know that's critical to getting more women and a greater diversity of ideas funded. But even that number, I believe it's up from like 11% a couple of years ago. It's moving so slowly.
It really is, and it's not enough. We have a long way to go, and there is data which Kauffman Fellows has published along with a plethora of other data, including from Bloomberg, on the importance of cap table diversity, not only in terms of founding teams, but on the performance of those teams, on the performance of those boards, on revenues, on faster time to exit. So this is not about diversity for diversity's sake or even for the sake of a holiday like today. It's fundamentally good for business. It's good for investors, it's good for LPs, and it's good for our economy. So we really need to move the needle here. And I'm, again, excited to see all of the young talent that's coming to the table, people who may not have considered a future in venture before some of the role models that they've had the chance to see elevated in recent years.
Well, women can't change the world alone. We're going to need the help of men. And I'm curious, in the boardroom, are you seeing male investors, male check writers more open to women founders or women ideas, you know, or is it still the women funding the smart breast pump or the women's health tech solution?
Not only am I seeing investors more open to it, I'm actually seeing incredible companies that are innovating for women in women's health and in other areas that are founded by men. And some of those happen to be in my portfolio. And so I do think there has been a tide shift. There have been incredibly competitive deals that we've had the chance to participate in. And many of the folks coming to the table are men. And so it's really not a gendered preference here. I think folks are starting to see that this is fundamentally good for the world, good for our economy, and good for our investors.
What kind of role do you think investors have on keeping the pressure on, especially for younger startups where you are more involved, making sure they have diverse teams, making sure they have women on the board, making sure that women are promoted so that they don't become as sort of male-dominated as the big tech companies that have the power today?
It's absolutely critical, Emily, and it has to start in the earliest days. This is not something where you can check the box right before you go public and decide to add, a quote-unquote diverse member to your board because it's required at that point. It really does need to be baked into the DNA of the company at the founding stage. And again, I'm seeing that happening even in new co-creation in terms of the first hires, in terms of thoughtful founders who recognize the importance of that around the boardroom and around the cap table as well. It's very difficult to do it thoughtfully if you wait too long.
Women make up 30 to 35% of employees at big tech companies, but it's much smaller when you look at those prime technical roles, about 24% of those top tech engineering roles. You know, it's going to take years, decades maybe, for some of these bigger companies to change. It's like trying to turn the Titanic. How optimistic are you for the next generation of bigger tech companies? Are we on the right trajectory?
Yeah, well, speaking of data and 10 years, it was 10 years ago when I was at Google and they first released their diversity numbers, when it comes to women in computer science and technical roles. And they were dismal. And following Google, a number of the other large FANGs also released their numbers. And there were myriad efforts to address the gender gap starting in elementary school. I mean, we know now that these kind of biases and self-perceptions can be formed as early as 18 months of age. So it's not something that will move immediately and quickly. It's not that easy to generate multiple PhDs overnight. We have to start that early and that young. We have to see characters in TV shows that, you know, are excellent engineers and happen to be women, not exceptional because they are women. We need to see those types of role models on Bloomberg Tech, which you do constantly. This type of representation is absolutely critical, and I think that we'll see that precipitate over time in terms of the numbers. It won't happen quickly, but it can't happen quickly enough.
We try, but all of us, even us, can certainly do better. I want to ask about some of the most rapidly growing parts of the tech economy, crypto, Web3, for example. Do you see women, you know, taking a fair share of the pie in some of these burgeoning industries? Because I think the narrative is that some of these new tech sub-industries are still quite male-dominant quickly.
In many cases, they are, but there are incredible organizations coming to the table, like my BFF, that are working to change that, like Women in the World, and like our new partner at Lux, Grace, who's focused on Web3, among other things.
All right, Dina Shakir, Lux Capital Partner, thank you for bringing your optimism to us. I want to soak a little bit of that up and take that with me for the rest of this International Women's Day. Coming up, as Web3 is becoming a new focus for many companies, one blockchain project known as the Google of DeFi, aka The Graph, is gaining momentum. We'll have more on that next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Time for our crypto report now. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its potential long-lasting impacts. I want to bring in our next guest, Tegan Klein, the co-founder and head of business at Edge and Node, the team behind The Graph, which brands itself as the Google of the DeFi world. This is an indexing and query protocol organizing the world's open blockchain data and making open data a public good. Tegan, thanks so much for joining us. So I'm curious how you would describe the mission of The Graph and how do you make sure it doesn't become a centralized space for a space that wants to be decentralized?
Absolutely, yeah. So the Graph is on a mission to make all of the world's public data verifiable. And the Graph is organizing all of on-chain Web3 data. So kind of like what Google does for the traditional web, the Graph does for the Web3 space, and it is a public good. And it has been built in this decentralized way. So there are many nodes around the world that operate within the Graph ecosystem and many different contributors. So there's no like central point of authority within the Graph network.
I'm wondering, so what is the data then telling you, Tegan, about, sorry, Shanali, what is the data telling you about the what's going on in the macro environment right now? Obviously, we're really concerned about what this means for traditional assets. Bitcoin is sort of a non-traditional asset. Some thought it would be a safe haven, but as Shanali was talking about earlier, it's been very volatile like everything else.
Yeah, so macro has definitely been impacting short-term trading. It's definitely been impacting the crypto markets, but in my opinion, that's quite short-sighted. And I think based on some of the unfortunate current events that we're seeing in the world, you know, it's very clear why crypto is very important. Situations in Ukraine, Russia, Canada, people really can't get access, they can't get money into Ukraine. Many have had to flee and leave their belongings at home in Ukraine. In Russia, people can't get paid. The Central Bank of Russia might also get their assets frozen. And so crypto self-sovereignty really solves for this. But the markets kind of do their thing and we're really focused on building. And so the developer activity has not stalled. It's not declined. It's actually at an all-time high and it's growing faster than it ever has before. And Electric Capital, they put out a dev report that showed over 18,000 open source devs joined the space and joined the Web3 space in 2021. So that's up 75%. And that's in line with what we've seen within the Graph ecosystem. There are over 28,000 developers building on the Graph today.
Well, as more developers build on the Graph and as more people, ordinary people who have never transacted in Bitcoin before or crypto for that matter, start to use the cryptocurrencies, do you think that centralization serves more of a purpose, that verification is more important?
I think decentralization is crucial. So you need to decentralize not just ownership, but power, decision-making, control. All of that should be decentralized. It shouldn't be at a platform's authority. It shouldn't be at a platform's ability. The platform shouldn't be dictating who is on the platform, who's allowed to speak on the platform, the truth on that platform. I think that decentralization is very crucial, but transparency, open source, permissionless, trustless tech is also, those are also core values within Web3.
But it feels like this is really getting tested, this entire notion, when you have people being kicked off, right? You have people like Coinbase or exchanges like Coinbase essentially serving as a central mechanism to really police behaviors here. How does that test what decentralization means in this industry?
So I think it's very clear that exchanges like Coinbase and also platforms like OpenSea are that just that, they're platforms, they're centralized. And that's why it's very important to self-custody your assets so that you have control in kind of this decentralized way. And that way no one can take that away from you. I think this, the situation that's happening now is triggering a lot of memories for a lot of people that have had to flee their countries and they were left with nothing. And, you know, with crypto, you can take it with you so long as you are self-custodying and you're not leaving that on a centralized exchange.
We're getting closer to a White House executive order on crypto, and there's continued to be a lot of uncertainty around crypto regulation. What are you bracing for here and what would you like to see?
Yeah, great question. So this executive order is not a huge deal. It's something that we've been anticipating for quite some time. And so what it is, it's expected to kind of instruct agencies to study and come up with a plan. And so that study will likely pick up on a lot of the regulatory themes that the industry has been focused on for many months, many years. So like consumer protection, regulating securities and security exchanges, and then also compliance with anti-money laundering. So I do think that it's good that the administration is starting to study these issues, or they're studying these issues further rather than just kind of attempting to blanket regulate, because I think that that can stifle innovation and kind of push it overseas. And so I'm excited to see more like the knowledgeable founders within the Web3 space and the crypto space help to regulate or help to help to educate regulators.
Speaking of what regulators do in the U.S. versus abroad, I mean, when you look at kind of the ecosystem that exists, do you think that there is more innovation moving abroad given, you know, FTX in the Bahamas and, you know, so many companies forming in India and other places around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see that regulation stay here in the U.S. and not move overseas. And so I am looking forward to kind of working with regulators so that we can keep that innovation here in a safe way.
All right. Tegan Klein, EdgeNode co-founder, thank you for joining us. The Google of DeFi. Check it out. Bumble just released fourth quarter results, beating estimates, the dating app joining the growing list of companies cutting ties with Russia. I want to get the latest with Evercore ISI analyst Shweta Khajuria, just got off the earnings call. Shweta, this is significant for Bumble because of their huge subsidiary, Badoo, which is a big dating site focused on Europe with some users, as I understand, in Russia. How big a deal is this?
It is. So they actually did disclose during the call that Russia accounted for about 2.8% of their business last year, and they are guiding the full year revenue growth, excluding Russia, for full year 22, and that implies about 2% of their business. So not a huge piece of the parent company, but meaningful exposure for Badoo, which is part of Bumble's business.
So how much of an impact do you think this could have on the business, which, to be fair, has been struggling when you look at some of the activity?
Okay, let me point you to a few things. Core business for Bumble actually seems to be running very smoothly. So let me give you three data points. One is their full year 2022 guide, if you exclude the impact from Russia, is very, very strong for Bumble app, which has very small exposure to Russia itself. So not Badoo, but the Bumble app. The core app expects their growth rate to be about 34 to 36% year over year, meaningfully above where their street was. That implies that their payer growth or the net additions in their payers will be greater in 2022 than in 2021. Street was not expecting that. Third is that if you exclude the impact from Russia, they expect 100 basis points of EBITDA margin expansion. So the revenue growth would be about 26%, EBITDA margins to expand 100 bips year over year, and payers are growing at a very healthy clip. So the core business, excluding Russia for Bumble, seems to be firing on all cylinders. Now, if you include Russia, then yes, they guided down for the full year because they are closing their operations. They have about 120 people there, closing their operations in Russia completely. So they will face some headwinds there, but the core business seems to be running fairly smoothly.
And what's your take on how the macroeconomic uncertainty could impact consumer behavior, whether or not people want to date and buy those Bumble subscriptions?
So there are two things. The demographic and geographic exposure that Badoo has is meaningfully different from that of Bumble. So the Bumble app users are different. They are in English-speaking countries and in mostly the developed world. And they're seeing less of an Omicron headwind or an impact because of the development of video and audio, et cetera. And in fact, their full year 22 guide does not have any meaningful tailwind of reopening economies. It's a different story for Badoo altogether. Badoo is more in the emerging market countries, including Russia, and they're seeing a little bit more of an impact from COVID. Now, they do expect as economies open up, they should benefit from reopening economies, but that is not baked in their guidance. A little bit of an Omicron headwind for Badoo, but less so for Bumble.
Is this kind of a bummer for Bumble, given that, you know, we're on the tail end, hopefully, of this pandemic, which, you know, I imagine would have been a big tailwind for Bumble and in-person dating?
It should continue to be a tailwind. I mean, if we actually look at what Match, their biggest competitor, is saying about Omicron as well as COVID, there is reason to believe that there is meaningful upside to Match's guide if the recovery in Asia, for example, Japan, which is their number two market, is better than expected. The same thing applies here for Bumble. I think if the reopening is better than expected, they could have upside to their guidance, and it could be actually beneficial to Bumble.
All right. Shweta Khajuria, Evercore. Thanks for breaking it down.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology on this International Women's Day. Join us again tomorrow. We've got a conversation with Cruise CEO Kyle Loeb as he takes the throne again, and an interview with the CEO of Marqeta, Jason Gardner. This is Bloomberg.